There is an endless sea of podcasts about entrepreneurship. Talking about it, but not living it. We live it every day. This is Inside the Wolf's Den, an entrepreneurial journey with Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel, talking about real estate investing, but also encompassing general subjects in regards to owning small to medium-sized businesses, and of course, all the struggles that business owners must overcome to be successful. This is Inside the Wolf's Den, and this is Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel.
Welcome back, everyone, to Inside the Wolf's Den. Today, we actually have a special guest to share with you, Colin Murphy. Colin, thank you so much for being with us today.
And thank you. It's an honor, Joni.
Yeah, thank you. And Colin is originally from Ireland, and he's been investing in the U.S. since 2009. Since then, he has bought and sold more than $100 million worth of real estate. That's awesome. Including 350-plus fix and flips in the Tampa Bay area between 2015 and 2020. He has experience in a variety of real estate activities, including buy and hold, fix and flip, wholesaling, tax liens, tax deeds, foreclosure auctions, note investing, private lending, and more. Colin, you have also lived in Madrid, Spain, and was an active flipper and landlord in Florida, single-family homes during that time. In addition to investing, he is the host of the Colin Podcast about Real Estate Show. Is that correct? Oh, that's
it
awesome.
Is.
Thanks. And why don't you give some of our listeners a little background on you?
Yeah, sure. So I'm 41 years old now. I've been involved in real estate since I was about 23. So a long time now. I don't think I'm qualified
or able to do anything else. Yeah, you look a lot younger than 41, so you're doing something right. Yeah. So.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's good Florida sunshine. You know, so yeah, I mean, I originally got into real estate in London. I worked there and lived there, I think, from about 2003 to 2006. And I started on the media side of things. So I worked for this great company called Blending Communications, who published a lot of real estate magazines and organized real estate trade shows and exhibitions all over the United Kingdom and Ireland. So my job was to convince realtors and developers and currency companies to place adverts in the magazines, like a quarter page, a half page, a full page, get as many months in advance as I could, and also to convince them to buy space at the different shows. So it's like, we got Liverpool this month, we got Manchester, then we got Dublin, then we got London. And so it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of, you know, sales calls. There was an awful lot of traveling as well, not just to all those shows around the UK and Ireland, but also to countries all over the world. So I was traveling to places like, you know, Bulgaria and France and Spain and Panama and That's Florida awesome. And all over the place, talking to all these people, Turkey, trying to convince them to pitch their products to the British and Irish buying public. So it was a mixture of kind of investment properties and vacation homes. And so it was an awesome way to get involved in this industry. And it was the perfect way for a kind of high energy 24-year-old to kind of dive into that work hard, play hard philosophy. And I kind of moved from the, you know, advertising sale side of things to just getting into real estate properly when one of the companies I worked with was another young company. They were the first British company to offer real estate in places like Latvia and Lithuania and Belize. And then they became developers themselves, an incredibly ambitious young company. And they asked me to open up an Irish office for them. They had an office in London, and they decided to open up one in Dublin as well. So I was promoting their products to an Irish audience. So I would, you know, organize hotel seminars, take out adverts in the local magazines, travel to all the places where they were building and selling real estate in Central and South America and Eastern Europe, and just, you know, fill an office full of salespeople, marketing people, admin people, accounting people, and just have a lot of fun. And this was back in the, you know, early to mid 2000s. You know, I opened that business in, I think, late 2006. Which, you know, a lot of your listeners might remember as just the tail end of the last boom. You know, right. We had quite a real estate boom from about 2002 up to about 2007. Mm-hmm. And it was just as big in Europe as it was here. Irish real estate prices, Spanish real estate prices, British real estate prices, they were all going through the roof during that period. And everybody was hyper enthusiastic. People lost all sense of you know, risk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ireland in particular went from being one of Europe's kind of poor countries, kind of stuck on the western edge of Europe, you know, for most of its life. But from the kind of early 90s to the mid 2000s, it had a bit of an economic miracle. I used to call it the Celtic Tiger period, where we went from being one of the poorer countries to one of the richest in the world on a per capita basis. But unfortunately, our financial IQ didn't increase as quickly as our you know, bank balances, and people took a lot of risks and bought a lot of crazy real estate. So yes, the crash affected it really badly. And, you know, obviously when 2008 came along, you had Bear Stearns crashing in March 2008 and Lehman Brothers in September 2008. And during that kind of 6 month period, my business model, which was mostly promoting pre-construction real estate in you know, second and third tier countries, it just evaporated completely, and demand fell off a cliff. I had to, you know, lay off 3/4 of the staff, basically run the budget from a shoestring, and then slowly begin the transition onto the next thing, which was Florida real estate.
Mm-hmm. That, I didn't realize the European markets, you know, boomed at the same point of or time as the U.S. did. So it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you think about moving or working in the U.S. and what attracted you to that?
Well, my business partner at the time, David Shaw, he was also Irish and he was a little older than me, and I'd hired him to work with me in that Irish company. And so, you know, we're working together, we're acting as basically business partners even back then, and we're thinking, well, what do we need to do to continue paying the mortgage, because it's not going to be selling these Eastern European and Central American properties, that's gone. Yeah. And so David had bought and sold a property, I think, in Kissimmee, just south of Orlando. And he'd done quite well, but he'd bought it, I think, in 2003 and sold it in 2006 and made some money. So he had his finger on the pulse a little bit on the Orlando real estate market. And he said, well, you know, if emerging market real estate business model is gone, what about distressed real estate in Florida? Because, you know, that's obviously a first world market. That's a dollar denominated currency, the safest in the world. He was hearing stories of a lot of distressed developers out there and distressed real estate. So we kind of took, you know, a sizable chunk of what money we had left and booked a couple of plane tickets to Orlando and set up some meetings with developers and brokers and agents and property managers. And you might remember that in the run-up to the Great Recession, a lot of people made fortunes during condo conversions.
Oh, absolutely.
Where a developer, yes, might buy, you know, 150 apartments for $6 million, spend $1.5 million modernizing them and fixing them up, and then selling them as individual condos for maybe $9 million, mm-hmm, and make $1.5 million profit in a 3-year period. So there's a lot of people did that, especially in markets like Orlando. And what happened, of course, is, you know, that finance for condos evaporated as well. It literally was available 1/4 and then was totally unavailable the next quarter. So you had all these developers that were stuck with all these condos that were falling in value dramatically. I mean, we used to sell stuff for $70,000-$75,000 that was retailing for $220,000-$230,000 the year before. Yeah. And so we, you know, basically promoted ourselves as, well, look, I've got a lot of the database of a lot of cash buyers from overseas, British, mm-hmm, and Irish buyers for the most part, also a handful in Australia and Canada and South America. And why don't you allocate 30 of these condos to me, give me exclusivity on them for 2 or 3 months, and we'll agree fixed prices for the 1, 2, and 3 beds, and we'll put cash buyers on them for you. And by this stage, a lot of developers had already tenanted them because, mm-hmm, they needed some money to cover their mortgage payments because their condo conversion model was gone. And so we promoted a lot of condos that way in Orlando, and then we moved on to do a bunch of them in Tampa as well. We did some in Jacksonville, we did some in Charlotte, and it was going quite well. And David and Catherine moved over full time. They were in Dublin at the time, and they moved over, you know, kind of in the early stages of that, and we continued growing it, and we did well, and we were one of the early players in that kind of, yeah, selling distressed condos to investors market back in 2009. But, you know, you'll probably remember that nothing lasts forever, and the big guys weren't long coming in, the big hedge funds, the high net worth investors. And, you know, whereas we used to be selling kind of B-class condos for about $80,000 that were rented for maybe $950,000, you know, you fast forward a couple of years and I was being offered C minus stuff and borderline D stuff for $100,000. And yeah, it's like, well, I'm not promoting that crap. And we,
and these were all led to foreign,
to another transition.
Foreign investors that you were promoting to.
Absolutely. For the vast majority of them, I mean, we slowly got some American investors over time, but the majority, especially in those early days, were just British and Irish buyers. I mean, a lot of people were suffering during the Great Recession, but a lot of people were also sitting on a lot of cash and didn't know what to do with it. I mean, didn't feel safe even leaving it in banks a lot of the time. But if you can say, well, here's some 1995 real estate for 30 cents on the dollar with a 9% cap rate and it's tenanted, I mean, that's pretty safe. And it's in Florida, pretty
how'd you feel about
safe international market.
Yeah, the business from, at that time you were still in Dublin or in Spain?
I was dividing my time between Dublin and Madrid. My wife is Spanish, so I moved to Spain from London back in late 2005. And then I used to spend half my time in Dublin running that Irish business, literally back and forth 2 weeks a month. And so I was, just dividing my time between both places, but really based in Madrid. And then when we set up the new business called Torcana, promoting Florida real estate, I was permanently based in Madrid because I didn't really have anything that I needed to do in Dublin. So it was, I mean, you'd be amazed at what you can manage from overseas. And even in 2010, and you know, we didn't have a lot of the advantages we have now, but you can still get a brochure done, negotiate with somebody, promote it by email, work with local brokers to get, you know, the transaction process, local property managers to get them managed. And you can do it if you have
Do you have any other like tips, do you feel, for, and you're going to, we'll get into your story, what you're going to continue to do. But I mean, do you have tips for managing? It seems like you're real relaxed with managing a business from a distance. I mean, because we manage, you know, Albuquerque, which is a 2-hour flight, but I can't imagine, it's a whole different, I'm sure, perspective managing something overseas.
Yes, but for me, there isn't much difference in something being a 2-hour flight or a 9-hour flight. It's not like you're going to personally impact much more than a couple of times a year anyway. I mean, what's the point in flying back and forth 2 hours every month to look at something? It's just a waste of time. So you need a good property manager, as you know very well, because you guys are great property managers, will make the difference between making a solid buy, a great rental, or a solid buy, a horror show. I mean, if you place a good tenant and then the owner of the property has the discipline to actually look at their management statements every month and kind of track anything unusual and have, you know, maybe quarterly phone calls with their managers and, you know, be proactive and kind of decent and generous to their tenants, it's fine. I mean, the good property manager is essential. And, you know, there was plenty of demand for good quality. I mean, there's always good demand for good quality, well-renovated, well-managed properties. You'll always have a good tenant in there. And you don't, I mean, I own properties, you know, out of state. I own properties that are 30 minutes away. I mean, I don't visit the ones 30 minutes away any more often than the ones that are 2 or 3 hours away.
It's a good point that you make that, you know, working remotely or afar, you having a real estate team behind you is essential. Like having, you know, your realtors and your property managers and, you know, your title companies makes it easy for you. You can pretty much invest anywhere as long as you have the right team in place.
You do. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I kissed my fair share of property management frogs in the early days. They're not, you don't, the great property manager just don't walk up and shake your hand and say, I'm the right guy. I mean, they all look the same when you first meet them, you know, but eventually you get lucky. Maybe you find someone, you know, maybe you just get lucky and find a great one at the beginning, and maybe you have to go through a couple of bad ones before you latch on to a good one and learn what, you know, some good questions to ask are and how to verify that they're actually good managers and get some references from other investors that have worked with them.
Absolutely. Sure. Vetting them, making sure that they're the right fit for you.
So take me through what in your opinion makes a good buy and hold investment, you know, since you've had a lot of experience, but and you know, both of our clients, you know, are typically not in our market, you know, and they're buying either overseas or they're buying, you know, from California or a different state. But what do you feel makes the best buy and hold?
I've always had the most success in lower middle class single family homes. I mean, I've sold and owned a lot of condos and they're fine. But at the end of the day, the HOA kind of controls how the show is run, and you can't affect if they're managing it properly, if they're, you know, maintaining adequate reserves for those roof replacements and pool maintenance and all the rest of it, and all that eats in all those swimming pools and tennis courts and security guards, and you know that eats into your operating income quite a lot. So single family homes are a lot simpler, not in HOA areas, and I've always enjoyed being kind of just one step below the middle of the ladder. I mean, there's always people, you know, people are moving up the ladder during a boom and they're moving down the ladder during a crash, but there's always the most demand, both from a rental and a resale point of view, in that lower middle class area. It's the most affordable, it's the most rentable, you're above the low end, you know, kind of the low end properties, which have a lot more vacancy and maintenance headaches, and you're below the kind of high end properties, which look beautiful and are nice to live in, but you know, they don't cash flow as well. A $400,000 house doesn't earn four times as much money as a $100,000 house. I mean, it's the yeah. cap rates are much lower. So I've always been comfortable in the, you know, $130,000 to $200,000 range with single family homes, where your kind of gross rent ratios are in the 0.8% range nowadays. They used to be higher, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And just renting out to kind of local people. I've never been a big fan of going to areas where there's a lot of, you know, you're relying on tourist income, for example, or you're relying on seasonal workers, or you know, relying on kind of gig economy people like Uber drivers and things like that, where you're just relying on local people to work in local hospitals, local schools, work for the local government as, you know, police officers or admin people in a county office. I mean, stuff like that, that's very kind of boring and very predictable, but mm-hmm. it's solid. And I've, you know, I've also kind of stayed away from flood zones. I've stayed away from really old houses that have a frame construction and stayed with newer. And newer for me is kind of post 1970 block construction. Yeah. And you can get a lot of these, I would call them kind of old lady nice houses that are perfectly solid structures and just need new floors, kitchens, bathrooms, roofs, and they're practically as good as new and cash flow a lot better than a home that was built in the 2000s.
Yeah, we follow the same philosophy, and it works, and it no matter, I think the timing in the markets too, like, you know, even in a recession or something, people are, they might step down, you know, but they're always stepping down to that, you know, so they might go from an A to that B, you know, and then mm-hmm. at the same time, there's always people just entering the market or just coming out of school or, you know, and stuff like that and entering that B. So it seems like there's just always a large tenant pool that keeps you consistent no mm-hmm. matter what market your cycle you're in at that time. So
I think so. I mean, if you have a kind of a B minus property or even a C plus property and you maintain it well and maintain adequate reserves, you'll cash flow fine through any market cycle. I mean, mm-hmm. you won't really need to sweat the kind of dramas at all that other people do.
Yeah, I agree. And tell us, I know you have a philosophy that, you know, investing is a journey and you go through different phases. Would you mind sharing what those phases are that an investor will go through?
You do, and I've been through a handful of them. I mean, and you know, we transitioned from kind of selling those condos into just becoming fix and flippers ourselves back in 2014, and it's a totally different business, just kind of being a kind of a marketing, you know, having a slick marketing operation promoting condos to people to actually buying houses and finding contractors to fix them up and sell them. It was a very different thing, and it was a, you know, steep learning curve, but the only way to do it, the only way to learn it is to do it. And that, I mean, I've had different real estate journeys, and I feel like I've kind of made these pivots every 5 years, you know, during the last 25 years, from kind of media sales to selling other people's properties to an Irish market to, you know, selling our own properties and collecting admission to flipping houses. So it's all a journey, and the only way to get anywhere is to do it, to take action, to learn from your mistakes and keep going. I mean, just you need to continually push yourself to take action. And you also need a very healthy attitude to risk. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have a healthy attitude to risk, you'll probably end up working for somebody that does. You know, that's always been my, you know, personal philosophy. So I'm all for, you know, I always enjoy learning new things in real estate, whether that was, okay, we buy a bunch of houses on the MLS and flip them. Okay, well, what if we work with wholesalers? What if we can buy them in foreclosure auctions? Uh-huh. You know, what if we can figure out how to buy tax deeds? What if we can kind of borrow other people's money instead of using our own money? Or, you know, what if we can lend people money instead of borrowing money as well? So you just, there's always stuff you can learn. What if we can buy and flip land as well as buying and flipping houses? So there's always stuff to learn in real estate. And I'm, you know, probably a naturally very curious person, and I love kind of doing all of that. I love kind of trying out new things. But the big caveat is, you know, I only really got successful in real estate was when I went kind of, you know, 3 inches wide and a mile deep. You know, I used to be promoting real estate initially all over the world, and then all over the, you know, eastern seaboard of the US, and then eventually within a 10-mile by 3-mile kind of box of Northeast Tampa, where we just buy hundreds of properties in this western part of Pasco County. And it was only when we got that expertise and that, and we kind of scaled up from buying, you know, 15 houses the first year to, you know, 100 houses last year, 120 houses last year, that you do really well, where you're able to kind of have multiple crews and multiple people working on your closings, your purchases, your you know, your bird dogs driving by the stuff that's coming up at auction. And you can only really kind of scale and become successful, I think, once you go deep. But I think at the same time, never lose that curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's a great point, because you become an expert in that area, you know. So when people call in with a deal or something, like, you know, the street that they're probably talking about, the type of homes that are in that neighborhood, you know, the rents, you know. And so you become that, that, and then, you know, the, you know, weather condition, everything. So you become, you know, just an expert on at a really small area than trying to cast that net so wide. So I think it's a great point. Yeah.
You kind of develop those ninja skills where you, you know exactly what the price is, because you sold three that were very the exact same in the last 3 months. And you know exactly what they're renting for. And, you know, like you say, you know where you say, no, that street's actually near a busy corner, or, you know, there's a scruffy kind of, you know, trailer home park right behind it. So we're going to have to deduct, you know, 10% from the ARV. And, you know a bunch of stuff just off the top of your head. So you can move extremely quickly.
And I think it minimizes your risk and as well, I think, in the long term. Or you can, you know, a deal that maybe has a smaller profit margin, but you know it so well and you know that area so well that you can take that risk, because you know that it takes exactly $25 a square foot for that particular house to rehab it. So you got it dialed in.
And you have your systems. You're literally putting the same kitchen into dozens of houses, the same paint color, the same vanity, the same roof contractor, the same floor guy. I mean, you're literally repeating the same thing all the time. I mean, I'm sure our crews were bored to tears of building the same bathroom and the same kitchen countertops every single week. But, you know, once you latch onto a kind of a system that works, you freshen it up every year or two, but otherwise it's rinse and repeat, you know, and that makes it, again, a lot easier. If you're planning a renovation from start to finish and you have to decide there's like a list of 100 things to buy. But if you can get to a stage where you're just, hey, Joe, just do the same thing you did in the last house, you know, it's so much easier.
What drives you though? And that, you know, you'd mentioned about taking risk as an entrepreneur and, you know, I think you like the challenges and the curiosity, but what drives you? What made you push yourself and, you know, all those years?
I know, it's funny, because I mean, I grew up in an Irish fishing village, very kind of small, you know, idyllic setting. You know, my mother worked in a hotel, local hotel. My father was a civil servant. You know, none of us, I'd nobody in my family that was involved in real estate. I didn't know anybody growing up that owned rentals or anything like that. I mean, just, you know, every now and again, somebody would announce, maybe when they were like in their mid-50s, here, I've paid off my house. I said, oh my God, that's incredible. You've paid off your house. That's just an amazing achievement. That's the pinnacle. Don't have to pay a mortgage. So it was never any kind of investment mindset at all. But when I went to university, you know, I started hanging around different types of people that had, you know, parents that were doctors and lawyers and so on. You know, during 2 summers in university, the first summer I went to San Francisco for 4 months and dragged 5 local buddies with me. And I worked for a local IT consultancy group. So we're basically traveling around hospitals in San Francisco, installing these Cisco 6500 servers, which was just an awesome experience. This was back in 1999, so it was the dot-com mania, and I was in the Bay Area, and I was hanging around with 23-year-old millionaires bombing around in Porsches and giving us rides to restaurants and all the rest of it. So I was just, my eyes were open. Oh my God, look at the possibilities in this country. And then the following year, I went to this great university called the University of Limerick, and they incorporate your third year of a fourth-year degree is basically an entire year of work experience. So a lot of people just take the safe option and get a job with, you know, their dad's friends in the local town, or some might go to Dublin or London, but others, you know, go further afield. So I went to New York for 10 months and I worked with New York Life Insurance Company, which is on Madison and Fifth Avenue. They've got that beautiful gold steeple on it. So I had an amazing experience in New York, again, hanging around with a lot of exciting young people, and just my eyes were open to this incredible entrepreneurial society. And I just got this hunger in me, this kind of fire in my belly from those experiences. And then I was, again, I went to London. London is an incredibly dynamic and vibrant city. And I just, I sucked that up as well. And I just got a super enthusiastic, work hard, play hard outlook. And again, I just, you know, saw this young company that had set up their own business and were doing incredibly well. And I opened up their Dublin office. And from then on, I kind of decided, well, look, if I can open up a Dublin office for these guys, why can't I just open up my own company and just design my own business with some local business partners and just figure it out as we go along? It was a lot of fun. Yeah. So I think it was just a mixture of those early experiences going to the US when I was, you know, 19, 20, 21. And then those kind of 3-4 years in a very, very vibrant London, that kind of gave me that drive and that fire in my belly, that, and it's just been a lot of fun ever since.
Do you think though that drive or that, you know, willing to get out of your comfort zone and do all that, do you think it, because we get asked this a lot, do you think it's something that can be, is it natural, or is it something that, and that tolerance for risk you know, because you traveled all over, and that there's a lot of people that say, no, I'm just going to stick, you know, near mom or near home, or not take that kind of risk. What do you do you think that can be taught, or do you think it's just you know?
I mean, it's obviously that? Easier if you kind of have a natural affinity for it, and obviously you need a balance, because if you're just kind of gung ho, risk everything, you're going to go bust every 3 or 4 years. And so I kind of balance that, you know, attitude of, well, I'm going to make a go of it. But I never went bankrupt. I always have a get rich slow mentality, you know, Sean and Joni. I've never took excessive gambles with my business. I never tried to expand too fast.
Yeah.
You know, we were always, I'd flipped 45 houses before I even borrowed money from somebody. You know, we were very, very cautious in the way we approached things. But once we decided to do something, we were really going to do it and give it a go. But we made sure we had the reserves to do it. And obviously, it's one thing setting up a business on a shoestring budget when you're 25 and you don't really have much, you know, responsibilities in terms of mortgages and children. But, you know, it's another thing when you're, you know, 35 or 40, you tend to be a little more cautious. But at the same time, I have the reserves nowadays where I can take proportionately bigger gambles, and if they don't work out, it's okay. But I've kind of, the experience I've gained and the people I've met and the kind of other people I can kind of get advice and guidance from always minimize my mistakes. So I'm never, you know, I think you need to balance it. I think if you're a hyper conservative person that hates taking risks, you should probably partner up with somebody that's a little bit the other way inclined, and you kind of balance each other out, because you do need somebody who is the risk taker, because you can't make money without having
a partnership up as well, because, you know, Sean and I are in partnership together, and it's not easy, you know. So talk about maybe some of the strengths that you had versus your partner and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, my main strength was kind of very analytical, kind of data-driven person who is able to stare at spreadsheets for hours and hours on end to figure out what the cash flow is going to be, what the offer price is going to be, what profit margins are acceptable, how to manage the cash flow coming in and out and the finances, and just like going through endless properties on the MLS and auction, or training a VA to do it. I'm very good at managing that whole thing, and David was very good at the project management side of things. Yeah. So he had a very good construction knowledge. He used to work in construction, managing, you know, school building projects in New York and stuff like that. So kind of renovating a house was very easy for him, and he was very comfortable. He could tell the difference between shoddy work and good quality work, which I basically couldn't and still can't to a large extent. So he was good at managing the renovations. He was good at being able to do the constant fighting that you often have to do with mm-hmm. your general contractors, right. especially in the early day. It's death by a thousand cuts, you know, and whack-a-mole. You tell them they're charging $300 too much on this item, and you'll find that they're going to try, if you discount it, they'll put it onto something else, and you're just constantly fighting with these guys to make sure you're bringing your budgets in on time and on budget. So he was extremely good at that, and he had the energy to hop in the car every day, drive an hour and a half, drive around 10, 15, 20 houses, and just whipping everybody into shape. And it's an exhausting kind of thing to do, but he did it for years and years and years. And then Catherine was very good at the back office side of things, about the admin and the office support, mm-hmm. just making sure everything got signed, everything was done, the bookkeeping was kept up to speed, the contractors were getting paid, and you know that we were, you know, that the ship was running along, and everything, you know, that the back office side of things was safe, and that the books were getting paid, and that we were paying our taxes every year, and we were getting, you know, getting that side of things done. So it worked out pretty well, the mm-hmm. kind of that, you know, three different skill sets there, with the back office support, the kind of field experience, field management and construction experience, and then I was more the kind of the strategy and data guy.
Yeah, and that brings me to my next point with the I know you're taking maybe a pivot, you know, in your company now and doing some stuff. I think your own, you know, maybe down, scaling down, doing your own real estate deals, looking mm-hmm. at moving again overseas. So this is a personal question for me, because I've always, how did you come to that conclusion that you were going to make that kind of move, and then and the mindset behind it, and the, because I guess as I've gotten older, I could pivot more, I think, when I was younger, because I didn't have mm-hmm. nothing to lose. I didn't have kids, you know, I could afford to, I never did lose it all. I never went bankrupt, but I guess I could and rebuild. But as I'm getting older and more assets, you know, I don't want to make a mistake that would, you know, so I'm always curious. And then, you know, to leave a business that you did for 12 years and start something new, mm-hmm. how do you not do you feel like you're losing like a part of your identity, or, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I you know, back in April 2020, which obviously the pandemic probably just accelerated something I was leaning towards anyway. It didn't happen because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. It maybe just accelerated it by 6 months or a year or something like that. But back in April, I took the step of splitting with my long-term business partners, David and Catherine Shaw, who I've been working with really since 2007 in the Irish business, and since 2009 in Torcana. So it wasn't a decision that I took lightly, but at the same time, it's been a very, you know, amicable and respectful parting, mm-hmm. and we're still working through it, because it takes longer than 6 months to detangle 10 years of work. We still mm-hmm. have various companies and properties in that we own in common to deal with, but we're doing it with a good attitude. But, you know, to kind of cut a long story short, I was fortunate enough to generate enough kind of liquidity and passive income streams that I was able to take a step back from one hectic business. And I also felt I was kind of living the same day over and over again. I mean, I was doing very well, I was earning a lot of money, but my routine was literally mind-numbingly boring, because and it needs to, you kind of have to do that to get wealthy, to be honest with you. But if you're just going from selling, you know, 50 houses in this area, and then 70 houses in that area, and then 90 houses in that area, kind of, even if you're outsourcing a lot of the, you know, the kind of donkey work, it's still, you get to a point where it's like, do I need to keep doing this? Do I need mm-hmm. to keep, is there something else I can do that's a little bit more interesting? And can I just do it myself? And I, you know, I just took a few months off, like from April to July, to deal with, I was dealing with, you know, homeschooling, mm-hmm. first of all, because my wife is Spanish, so she's not a native English speaker. So I was kind of homeschooling the kids back in kind of March, April, May. My kids are 8 and 10, so that was a huge pain in the ass.
It was a lot of work, I'm sure.
You have a whole new, we do the same thing, and you have a whole new respect.
It was, and I went from kind of, I've always worked in home offices, so I went from working on my own nice and calmly and hopping the car every now and again to having everyone in the house all the time. But anyway, I took a few months off to kind of deal with that fallout from COVID, and also just to decide to build another much smaller business solely around my and my family needs. Because I'm planning to move back to Madrid, Spain in the next 6 to 12 months, and I wanted to create a business that would support that. And it wasn't really fair on David and Catherine to turn their world upside down to do it either. And subsequently, they've been taking some decisions with their own life and lifestyle that they might have felt bad doing with me as a business partner. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that involves, you know, just kind of making some additions to my personal portfolio, flipping a much smaller volume of slightly higher end properties. I lent a bit of money to wholesalers and rehabbers. I've been diving deeper into alternative assets like tax deeds, and I'm researching land flipping. I started a new podcast as well, which is a lot of fun, that, you know, just to help others on their real estate journeys. And, you know, funny enough, a lot of podcasts talk about scaling up, which is hard, because I've done it, you've done it even much bigger than I have, but it's a lot less stressful to downsize. Yes. Yeah. It's the scale.
We think about that all the time.
Even last night, we had a major episode with one of our companies, a big problem. And anyways, it was like...
It's easy to say, oh, like, man, I wish we were a lot smaller. We didn't have to deal with those kind of things, you know? But
I totally understand that. And look, and to go from being a kind of a partner, senior partner in a business with a lot of moving parts, doing maybe 10 flips a month, to kind of a more or less a one-man band doing one or two flips a month. I mean, to be honest with you, the actual difference in income isn't all that big. If you're on your own doing one or two flips a month, you can do pretty well. And you still have a ton of time to do podcasts and to do research and to take Fridays off and all the rest of it. So I've been enjoying the downsizing, and I'm enjoying the extra time it's given me to prepare the move back, to educate myself on other aspects of real estate and other opportunities that are out there. That, because when you're in your own business with tons of people and important business partners, you're always feeling obliged, well, I got to give everything to the business, because otherwise I'll feel guilty. I feel guilty if I spend 3 hours researching personal rentals in Ohio on a Friday morning. I feel guilty taking a Monday off to go golfing with my dad, you know. So I just decided, well, look, I've been working very hard for all my 30s, so let's just calm it down a bit and you know, smell the roses and just do something smaller, which can still give me a very comfortable lifestyle, and it's a lot less stressful, to be honest with you. So I've enjoyed the downsizing. I mean, it wasn't easy splitting up a business partnership, and it didn't just affect, you know, me and David and Catherine. It also affected a lot of other people. It affected, you know, affected the construction crews. It affected property inspectors, title agents, you know, investors that were used to buying 7 or 8 properties from us every month. I mean, to be honest with you, inventory basically dried up from March to June anyway, so we probably wouldn't have been giving them that much business, but it still was an extra big problem for the kind of wider circle. So I felt pretty bad about that for a while, but I'm at the end of the day, I'm designing my own journey around my, my family.
That's,
and
I'm
doing my best for me and them without without being nasty to anybody else. Yeah. You know, I think that's okay.
It's the whole you know, mindset of just building, you know, defining your life and your purpose or your vision, I guess is the best, your vision for your life, and then tailoring the business and, you know, to serve it rather than, you know, having us always serve our businesses, you know. And I think you've flipped it so that you can't,
because it's very easy to fall into the trap. Well, I don't know if trap's the right word, but it's very easy just to say, well, this year we've done X, how do we do X plus 30% next year, and how do we do X plus 30% the year after? But you know, there's more to life than just growing a bigger and bigger business, in my opinion. I mean, some people are just driven to get a big business, and that's where they get their happiness and their self-worth, and they want to live, I don't know, an ultra-rich lifestyle or something. I don't know. But, you know, real estate is kind of the only industry I know where you can have a very comfortable lifestyle without being a genius or without working, you know, 80 hours a week. If you're kind of careful about what you do, and what skills you develop, you can design a very nice and even a location independent lifestyle for yourself, as I'm doing, because I'll be back. I was in Madrid for 10 years doing Florida real estate, and I'll be back in Madrid in the near future, and I'll continue doing US real estate and probably some stuff in Spain as well. But it doesn't just happen unless you take some kind of dramatic steps in your life and you gotta plan it through.
Well, hopefully we get to visit you in Madrid.
That would be awesome.
I had a couple of questions that we just wanted to wrap up, because we asked these of all our guests. So sure. You know, what habits have helped you succeed either in business or in your personal life?
So kind of in, you know, as far as real estate concerned, and we touched on this earlier, you really do need an action oriented mindset, because the only way to progress is to take action, get experience, learn from your mistakes, move forward continuously, have a healthy attitude to risk. So you need to try and develop those habits carefully, or partner up with somebody that might have some of the traits you don't have. But it, you know, for a more general life habit, which is actually has a much more profound effect, and is something I work very hard to encourage in my children, and that is to take a very keen interest in reading from an early age. I mean, that's just huge. If you can get someone, whether it's yourself or your kids or whoever, to read books from a young age and develop the habit of reading every night, no matter how tired you are, because you just reading is fun, you'll be doing them a massive favor. Because if you think about it, if you have that habit, it'll improve your curiosity, mm-hmm. your imagination, your concentration, your vocabulary, your writing skills, and your ability to understand and process complex ideas. So it's really, if you have that habit, the whole world opens up to you. And again, that might be another reason why I was more ambitious than other people from my village, because I was a pretty voracious reader from an early age, and that kind of gave me some of the confidence and tools to do other stuff. And I'd just encourage everybody to develop that habit. It's never too late to do it.
Great point. That's actually one of our next questions. Are there any current books that you're reading right now that could benefit our listeners, or one of your favorite books?
Yeah, okay, I'll give you a couple. I mean, one of the best non-business books mm-hmm. I've read recently was called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind by Yuval Noah. It's an amazing and pretty easy to read book that blends history and science and gives you a sense of how briefly we've been on this earth and how short things like agriculture and science have actually been around. So it's a really thought-provoking but easy to read book, and I'd recommend it to anybody. It's a brilliant book. If you want a couple of business related books, I would recommend one called Mindset by Carol Dweck. Mm-hmm. That's Dweck. I think she's a professor of psychology at Stanford University, and she coined the terms fixed mindset and growth mindset, where growth mindset people understand that they have an ability to improve, to get smarter through being purposeful and working hard. And they do it. So check that book out for mindsets. And if you haven't read The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss, grab a copy of that too, because it's got some really awesome actionable tips on how to outsource unproductive tasks and developing location-independent income streams.
That's awesome. And last thing, if you had to, if you were starting all over again, and all the knowledge that you've gained over these years, what advice would you get to somebody that's at that point, is just starting out, maybe just got out of school, or, you know, what advice would you have for them?
So two things I can think of. The first piece of advice is to get up early in the mornings. If you can start your day with 45 minutes of quiet time and use it to pray, meditate, review goals, read something thought-provoking, I think you'll find that you become a much calmer person, better able to handle the curveballs and take advantages of opportunities that come your way. Mm-hmm. The second and kind of more practical thing is to develop a habit of tracking your income and expenses every month for your household, for your rentals, for your business. I think if more people spend 3 or 4 hours a month just building and reviewing their balance sheets and their P&L statements and understanding how they interact with cash flow, you'd find that you just naturally have more reserves for those rainy days, and you'd find it a lot easier to accumulate wealth and build income streams.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I don't think anybody said that so far. So that's brilliant. So great. I appreciate it. You know, we appreciate you being on this today, and I think you've added a lot of benefit to our listeners. And so, you know, keep in touch. We let us know when you do move, and we'll have to plan a trip to Spain sometime soon.
Yes. And Colin, how can our listeners find you?
Oh, okay. Well, I have a new website I set up a few months ago. It's called colininvestments.com. That's Colin investments.com. You'll find me on, you know, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram under either Colin Investments or Colin G. Murphy. I have a podcast, which you mentioned earlier. It's called Colin Podcasts About Real Estate. So if you just type that in, you'll find it on your podcast app. And I'm always happy to to chat to people about their real estate journeys. I set aside, you know, generally 3 or 4 20-minute slots in my calendar every week just to chat, typically to young people trying to get started with their first rental or people trying to get into wholesaling or flipping. So I'm very happy to do that to anybody as well. And yeah, that's it, colininvestments.com, and check out the podcast as well.
All right, awesome. colininvestments.com. Great. Well, thank you again, Colin, for joining us today. I'd love to hear your amazing story, and I learned a lot from you, so thank you for that. And thank you, everyone, for listening in, and we will see you next week.
You've been listening to Inside the Wolf's Den, an entrepreneurial journey with Sean and Joni Wolfswinkle. Tons of entrepreneurial podcasts are out there. Talking. But Joni and Sean are living it every single day. Their portfolio now includes many franchises and medium-sized businesses. We talk about the trials and motivators of successfully running a business. Join us again soon for another podcast. But until then, reach out on the website at InsideTheWolf'sDen.com, on Facebook at Inside the Wolf's Den, on Instagram at Inside the Wolf Den. We'll see you again soon. This is Inside the Wolf's Den. We'll see you next time.